Yesterday, your representatives convened in Springfield to take their oaths of office. Here's Senate President John Cullerton describing some of the newest members.
So within that caucus, we've got mechanical engineers and mathematicians, offensive linemen, and Air Force instructors. And if you want to get specific, Senator DeWitt can design you a new kitchen, and Senator Plummer will sell you the materials to build it.
And on Monday, Governor Pritzker will take a similar oath. But what will they do as your elected officials? Also, a new study finds that fake news is shared most by older Americans, and
Hurricane Maria slamming into the island. One official saying the island is destroyed. 150-mile-an-hour winds ripping buildings apart, knocking out power everywhere. All of the electricity is out tonight.
That's ABC describing Puerto Rico in 2017. An Illinois researcher shares how her work with natural disasters like Maria is now being used to help children overcome other trauma. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up on today's program, one new study says that older Americans are more likely to share fake news. And we'll speak with an Illinois researcher whose work helping children cope with natural disasters is now being used to help children process other traumatic events. First, yesterday, the state's newly elected representatives convened in Springfield to take their oaths of office. The Democrats have an even bigger majority than they did before. What do they want to get done? And can they? Helping us look forward to this year to come are Illinois Public Radio State House reporters Brian Mackey and WTTW politics reporter Amanda Vinicky. Both of them are at the State House as we speak in Springfield. Welcome back to the 21st. Happy New Year, guys.
Happy New Year.
Hello, Nyla.
Brian, let's start with Governor Rauner. He's preparing to say goodbye to the governor's mansion. But first, he addressed a letter to incoming members of the incoming 101st General Assembly. What did he say?
Yeah, this is part of what they're pointing out is a constitutionally required report, right? So we have the State of the State every year, which is understood to be part of the Constitution. But there's a second part of that clause that says you have to present a report to the General Assembly when you're leaving office. And so this letter that was sent was sort of a preview of what this more in-depth report is going to say. At the time he held the news conference to talk about it, that report wasn't ready. But basically, he touted what he regards as the accomplishments of his administration, such as increasing funding for K through 12 education in Illinois, improving the state's employment climate, and also warning of the things that he has said he's afraid are going to happen under unified democratic control of government, such as changing the state's tax system from a flat tax to a progressive or graduated tax and increasing taxes in order to fund government obligations.
I want to play a little bit of what Governor Rauner said, and then Amanda, ask you a little bit more about this press conference. But first, let's hear from Governor Rauner yesterday.
If you're going to be a moderate to win elections, but you're not going to be a reformer and fix the problems, what's the point of winning?
Amanda, do you think that's a bit of a theme of what he talked about yesterday?
You know, it was a theme, and I also have to say, so the governor, following the standard presentation of this report, answered questions from reporters for a really lengthy time, and I have to say it was a bit different. He opened up more than he has previously, including upon his reflections on the Illinois Republican Party, and I thought that was a significant part that you just played. He talked about both kind of the Governor Jim Edgar wing of the Republican Party being part of the problem, as well as the conservatives, sort of what you could think of as his primary opponent, who of course nearly eclipsed him and captured the GOP nomination, which would have been huge. Conservative, now no longer Representative Jeannie Ives, in saying that the Republican Party needs to be more inclusive, that just because you disagree 20% of the time, don't consider somebody an enemy and kick them out of the GOP. And nonetheless, on kind of the Edgar side, all right, you might need to be a moderate in order to win in Illinois, because it is such a blue state, as we clearly saw from the last election. But he asked, what is the point of winning as a moderate if then you don't reform? And he said the Republican Party is really part of the problem and joined with Democrats in making a lot of decisions that really kicked the can down the road financially. So that was certainly significant. Rauner really, like I said, opened up addressing issues that he hadn't previously, including also the Donald Trump aspect of the Republican Party. He said, after having asked repeatedly reporters, where are you at on the president and
for
his policies?
Years,
yeah.
We didn't get any answers.
He avoided it completely, right. The governor finally said, I agree with him on most of his policies. And he focused on, he said, wanting to put an end to illegal immigration. He said that that requires really making a change in terms of the policy to streamline making it so that immigrants can come here legally. But then he said that he is appalled by President Trump's behavior.
Amanda,
that was significant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is significant to have that condemnation of President Trump. But I want to ask where, if Governor Rauner, as he's talking about different wings of the Republican Party, is Jeannie Ives his opponent in the primary? He's talking about President Trump. He's talking about former Governor Jim Edgar. Where does he see himself?
We got somewhat of an answer to that. He said that he hopes that there will be good-hearted, reform-minded individuals that come forward to run for election in the GOP, and he will help with that. How he will help, whether he will continue to financially back the Illinois Republican Party, which he has generally been the primary subsidizer of these past few years and backing elections 2 years ago. But then we really saw him actually give a lot less this time around, and that may have contributed to the blue wave in last year's election. He did not specifically address that. He also notably did not completely close off a run for future public office, although I think given the shellacking that he took, I frankly would be surprised if we see him on the ballot anytime soon. But he didn't close that off. He said he's going to be spending some time focusing on his family, getting back into philanthropy, and trying to, again, get back into presumably private equity or some sort of, you know, building up businesses in that regard.
And I would just say one thing I think it's interesting that he didn't really reckon with, I don't think. He was asked, you know, given the, as Amanda put it, the shellacking he took at the election, given that voters overwhelmingly selected his opponent and repudiated his efforts, what does that say about his agenda? And what does that say about the sort of general anti-tax position we've seen from Illinois Republicans? And we have a candidate for governor who won a huge electoral victory by campaigning on giving Illinois a progressive income tax. And I don't think I've yet heard from Republicans really articulating you know, why their argument that that is going to be something terrible and that the people don't want that holds up given Pritzker's victory.
Let's get into some of those specifics. We're speaking with Brian Mackey and Amanda Vinicky about our upcoming new legislature. It's actually happening as we speak, as we were talking about the elective representatives newly elected that were convened in Springfield yesterday. Everyone taking their oaths of office, both first time and returning lawmakers. When we think about the state house, Amanda, there will be supermajorities in the Illinois House and Senate, and Governor Pritzker has that. So it's the same. It's the same party that is running, obviously, the both not just the governor's office, but the House and the Senate. So when we think about what's first on the agenda, what are you hearing from lawmakers about what they would like to have done?
So two things. First of all, Pritzker's already had a pair of wins, and we saw the bipartisanship that both he and Republicans have been preaching about come to fruition in Republicans helping him to pass this pair of bills to allow for a new tollway authority and also to allow Pritzker to pay incoming state agency directors a higher salary. That was sort of an interesting beginning. I'm not sure that those are the great wins. They weren't, but regardless, that was evidently something that Pritzker had wanted even before coming in as governor. I do think that there is going to be a lot of, or there should be a lot of pressure on Pritzker and Democrats to have their agenda realized, given that they have such strong supermajorities. There won't be any excuses, but we might see there be a division forming between more of the progressives and more of the moderates within the Democrats. Nonetheless, I think there you'll see Pritzker get some early wins, whatever that may be. He talked yesterday to the mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, who said that he expects Pritzker to sign a gun dealer licensing law that Rauner had vetoed. So we'll see Pritzker claim there that he's already taking action to try to tackle crime in the city of Chicago. Other things that are top on his agenda seem to be perhaps something with the minimum wage and increasing the minimum wage, getting a statewide capital bill or infrastructure program, but we don't have details on how that would be paid for. And I would say perhaps legalization of marijuana will be something that we could see getting acted on in this first session, that is. And again, anything that you can show Pritzker saying, hey, I'm taking action right away. This could be a year where they'll sort of coast and maybe that Democratic divide we'll see come later. That's an early possible prediction.
Brian, how significant is this supermajority?
I mean, it's significant. It's more helpful to have more votes than not, right? But it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be able to work your will. And frankly, given that there is a Democratic governor working with a Democratic General Assembly, it's not, you don't expect if they work cooperatively together that there would be a lot of things that, you know, they would have to override his veto on. Where it becomes really important is on things that do still require supermajority votes beyond vetoes, such as changing the Illinois Constitution, which is a necessary step for implementing a graduated income tax. It's also necessary to issue state debt, so that would be important for the infrastructure program. And while the Democrats do indeed have supermajorities, the way they've gotten that, and I'm kind of beating a dead horse, I've talked about this before, but the way they get to supermajorities is by being a very big tent party. So even though there are fewer Southern Illinois Democrats, conservative Democrats, you still have Democrats in the suburbs who are, you know, not as eager to vote for tax increases. They may still have, there are some Democrats who come from areas of the state where guns are still, Second Amendment rights are still an important issue. So they may not be willing to vote for the most restrictive gun legislation, such as a ban on so-called assault weapons, which Pritzker has said Illinois should do. So this is, it's better to have a supermajority than not to, but it's certainly no guarantee that Pritzker can just, you know, wave a magic wand and get his agenda through.
And when we're talking about Governor Pritzker getting his agenda through, you can't talk about Springfield without talking about House Speaker Michael Madigan and his agenda. And we've got some audio of Speaker Madigan. Here's what he had to say after being reelected as Speaker yesterday.
4 long years of character assassination, 4 long years of personal vilification, 4 long years of strident negotiating positions, also known as my way or the highway.
Amanda, Brian, what do we know about Speaker Madigan's relationship to incoming Governor Pritzker?
You know, this is something that reporters continually pressed Pritzker on throughout the campaign because Madigan was seen as really such a liability. You saw Madigan sort of gloat afterward and say that despite the 4 years of being vilified by Rauner, that clearly didn't work, given obviously the win of both Pritzker and that supermajority in the House that you were just talking about. We don't know a ton about their relationship. It was, I think, became clear that Pritzker was the favored candidate by many of those in Democratic leadership. Really, they were eyeing his campaign dollars. Is there more to it? Do they have a sort of close relationship? We don't really know. I do think that Pritzker has treaded carefully there, distancing himself publicly, but not very far from Madigan.
Just amplify that point, Amanda, I think that it was very noticeable to me during the primary. The easy thing for an Illinois politician to do in 2018 was to vilify Speaker Madigan and say he's terrible and he needs to go. And Pritzker went out of his way to not do that, even as other Democrats in the primary were insulting him left and right for that, saying, oh, he had to call Madigan to get permission to weigh in on this issue and that sort of thing. But he really went out of his way, acting as you would expect of someone who kind of expected he was going to have to win and eventually work with Speaker Madigan. And we know, I think, from reporting other people have done, that the way Governor Rauner campaigned and used Madigan as a tool in his 2014 election campaign really soured their relationship before he even took office, and led to the some of the bitter divide we had over the last 4 years that you heard Speaker Madigan refer to.
And there was one state representative, is it Stava Murray? I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing her last name correctly, of Naperville, who actually campaigned on saying that she didn't take any money from Speaker Madigan and she wasn't going to vote for him. How did she vote yesterday?
She did, in fact, follow through on that pledge. It was technically a present vote, but oftentimes I think you could see a present vote as sort of squirming out of a situation. In this case, there's really no alternative. It was either vote for Madigan or vote for
the
Republican.
So her present vote was not a vote for him. Okay.
I guess she could have entered somebody else's name. She could have said she was running herself. She could have nominated herself. She did not make a big show of it, at least on the stage during the inauguration ceremony, though certainly there was significant media attention both leading up to the vote and following. So yeah, her present vote counts as a no vote against Speaker Madigan, and that is something that is quite rare.
And can we, if I know we're running out of time, but just briefly say why she did that? She in fact, has a very progressive agenda and probably would agree with Madigan and Democrats on most issues. She specifically says it's the way he and his office has handled sexual harassment allegations, particularly within the Democratic Party and within the House Clerk's office, that she thinks that is why she doesn't have confidence in his leadership.
We are about to take a break. When we come back, Brian, Amanda, I wanted to just ask you about the people that were missing, some people who have been a big part of the Democratic Party in Springfield who are not part of this new class. I'm thinking about Barbara Flynn Curry. Earlier this week, we had news of Liu Lang. And so I want to ask you about leadership and what that looks like among the other positions across the state house. By the way, we are answering your questions. Those of you who are listening, our audience, it's called Ask the 21st. Ask the 21st, ask the 21st.org. And we're taking your questions that you have about the governor, about the state house. And we're going to try to answer some of them on Monday. We will have our special broadcast live from the Bank of Springfield Center and for the inauguration ceremonies. Brian Mackey is going to be with me again for that. But we'll continue this conversation with Brian and Amanda just after this short break. Stay tuned. You're listening to the 21st. You're listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Today we are talking about the state's newly elected representatives that convened in Springfield yesterday. The Democrats have historic control. We're talking about what they want to get done and can they, with Illinois Public Radio State House reporter Brian Mackey, WTTW Politics reporter Amanda Vinicky. Both of them are right now in the State House as we speak in Springfield. Brian, I just wanted to get to a conversation we were starting just before the break, which is we were talking about Speaker Madigan. We were mentioning some newer members. Can you share a little bit about the fact that Barbara Flynn Curry, a state house institution, she's no longer in office? I mentioned Liu Lang. Who else is missing and who's taken up more leadership roles within the Democratic Party?
Well, I mean, if you want to talk about over the last 2 to 4 years, a lot of people are missing. Mike Riopel, one of our colleagues at the Chicago Tribune, did a sort of spreadsheet and determined that about 30% of the General Assembly has turned over just in the last few years. And a lot of that is because of the pitched battle that happened down here. You have seen, and I think this is something that Governor Rauner doesn't really claim credit for, although he could, he set out to polarize the Republican Party in Illinois. You used to have pro-union Republicans in the legislature, and he picked them off one by one.
Well, and he talked about term limits a lot too, right, Brian?
He did. He picked off moderate pro-union Republicans, gave them appointments. He, you know, and others have chosen to leave after having to go against him and vote for a tax increase. They felt like, well, the mood in the state, you know, in a Republican Party dominated by President Trump, they were out of step with it, and they decided not to even try to seek re-election. And so he has succeeded in getting a lot of people out of the way. Whether that's a net benefit or not is an open question. It certainly left a lot of opportunities and vacant seats that Democrats, with the limitless money brought to bear by J.B. Pritzker, could swoop in and were able to capture this year.
Coupled, I think, with just in general blue wave kind of nationally, but particularly in Illinois, that was seen in areas as anti-Trump. But you saw that in the population center. So a couple of takeaways there. As Brian noted, Rauner did polarize the party in the regard to unions. It was like he wanted it polarized in one certain way, but as we talked about initially, he says, no, we don't want that in other ways. If you don't agree with me 20% of the time, don't be my enemy, except for on the issues that he saw is significant. He was saying, you know, just because there's a disagreement on abortion, don't split, for example, the Republican Party. But certainly we saw him not take his very own advice when it came to stances on the labor agenda. Also, I think another takeaway from the turnover in the state house on a broader level is, first of all, we did see a lot of the institutions leave. As you noted, Barbara Flynn Curry, Lou Lang, for example, same in the Senate. You know, James Claiborne left. Kwame Raoul is not gone, but he is no longer a member of the legislature. And I think we'll see more of this. Current Democrats who've been around for a while perhaps join the Pritzker administration. So more changeover there. And you saw Senate President John Cullerton highlight that, I think, trying to kind of take a jab at the call for term limits that we still continue to hear Rauner talk about, saying that the average length of term of a senator now is 7 years. And he talked about in his inaugural speech saying that that's powerful, that you want to have a mix of people who are new and aren't there. And one other point that I want to make here in terms of the turnover in this election is that you really saw it described somewhere as a downstate power outage. And that is that while Democrats made gains, they were very much in the suburbs. Democrats really lost downstate. That is where Republicans did succeed in picking up seats. But of course, they are still in the super minority. And that could have consequences for downstate because Democrats don't need to. If they kind of give up on any of those seats, that could have long-term consequences for issues that are of significance to rural and downstate areas.
I wanted to, speaking of, as we're talking about outside of Chicago, Republicans, I wanted to just play some audio from Jason Plummer. He's a Republican from Edwardsville. And he was talking about how there are issues that all Illinois lawmakers have to agree on. And the biggest one is problems that everyone knows that they have to solve. And one of the biggest is out-migration, especially when we're thinking about college students leaving the state.
There's a lot of families leaving the state. There's a lot of kids graduating school and leaving the state. And we have to make sure they stay here and they plant their roots and they grow their families in Illinois because it's a wonderful state to be in.
When we think about that, when we think about the budget, the fiscal situation the state is still in, as we wrap up here, guys, we just have a minute or two left. I just wanted to ask you guys about the bigger fundamental problems that the state is facing, what details we've seen from Governor Pritzker, what priorities we can see for all of the legislature that everyone will agree on working on this coming session. Brian, you want to start?
Yeah, I mean, Amanda talked about some of these things earlier, and I think we're going to see Pritzker pushing for cannabis legalization. He's also quick to add in an inclusive way, which means getting minority-owned businesses to be a significant part of that in the state. And he's also talked about raising the minimum wage in Illinois. And those are certainly things that will have opposition among Republicans, among the business community. But that is where these Democratic supermajorities will be put to the test.
Amanda?
So, yeah, I will echo what Brian said. I think those are some examples. I'll add that Rauner, that was one of the other big takeaways from his end of year report and his press conference. I think we kind of heard a clip from him saying that he's scared about that exodus because, of course, on that more long-term agenda is Pritzker's plan to move from a flat income tax to a graduated one. the idea of Rauner and Republicans is that any talk of taxes will continue to chase businesses away. Of course, we saw that that is something that Pritzker didn't want to talk a ton of details about throughout the campaign, and we still have not gotten any of those. But that's certainly something that I think is going to get a lot of attention because it has to. Brian actually has a piece right now. Pritzker made a whole lot of promises in terms of revitalizing a lot of areas, education, higher education, public, I mean, pick an area. And he said, we need to do more. We need to invest more. But where the money is going to come from is the big looming question, as it always is, but particularly now because so many promises were made and Illinois' financial situation continues to be so bleak.
To that point about Brian's piece, we'll tweet that out, and we are going to talk about that Monday. Brian, I'm going to save that conversation for you and I before the inauguration ceremony. Brian and I will be live from the Bank of Springfield Center on Monday for the swearing-in. We'll be carrying all of the speeches as well. I want to thank Brian Mackey with IPR, the State House reporter, and Amanda Vinicky. Amanda, it's always great to have you on the air. WTTW politics reporter. She's still our public media colleague. Brian, Amanda, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Good to talk to you, Nyla.
It was my pleasure. Thanks.
We've heard a lot about fake news, so much so that the extent that researchers are actually studying it now. And the good news about fake news is, according to one study that came out yesterday, when it comes to platforms like Facebook, which is where you might assume a lot of fake news gets circulated, the proportion of people who are sharing fake links is actually pretty low. Here's the bad news. According to this one specific study, the majority of people who were doing that sharing were older Americans, especially people over age 65. Here to tell us more about that research that was published yesterday in the journal Science Advances is someone who's also very interested in this topic of fake news, University of Illinois journalism professor Nikki Usher. She's in studio with me here in Urbana. Hi, Nikki. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
So I think when we hear about fake news, and I think media literacy is another term that's often included in this conversation, we oftentimes are very worried about younger generations and their ability to distinguish between real and fake. But this study suggests a problem with the other end of the age spectrum, right?
Yeah, and actually the interesting thing about this study is that it confirms a lot of early research that we've seen that suggests that indeed people with worse digital literacy also happen to be older, which makes sense, right? That makes sense. But, you know, I think the young, and another study suggested that people who had better Photoshop skills were better able to recognize fake news.
Regardless of whether it was print or...
Doctor photos. Like, so, I mean, what we're learning from this is that the digital literacy problem may not be solved by better high school education.
Yeah. And so it's also not just your age. It's also the political affiliation that matters when it comes to sharing fake news, right?
Yeah. So what we've learned is that older Republicans tend to share more fake news. What we don't know, because there was so much more pro-Trump, anti-Clinton fake news, is if there was an equal proportion of fake news across the spectrums, whether older Democrats would have also shared lots of fake news. But initial reports suggest that, you know, this is older Republicans doing most of the sharing of fake news.
So that's an interesting point. Perhaps they're doing most of the sharing because most of the fake news is actually Republican versus Democrats or liberal fake news.
Yeah. So that's something we really need to take into account. And there's a lot of moral panic around fake news. And what's really important to understand is who's doing it, why they're doing it, and to what effect is that sharing having.
If you have questions about this, by the way, you can tweet us. Our handle is 21STShow. You can give us a call quickly because Nikki and I are just going to be talking about this for about five more minutes. But our phone number is 1-800-222-9455, or you can tweet to 21STShow. To that point, Nikki, do we know why older Americans are more likely to have done this? In this particular research, how did they do that, and did they come to any conclusions?
So I can tell you a little bit about how they did the research, but I don't know if empirically, conclusively, we know why older people are sharing more fake news. But what they did, what these researchers did, is they had a panel, which means a consistent sample of people that they went back to throughout the election for a bunch of surveys, so about 3,500 of them. And then they asked those folks to share their Facebook feeds with them. One of the biggest problems researchers face in studying Facebook and fake news generally is that Facebook data isn't
isn't available for us.
And
to
Facebook
actually
hasn't
study.
Been, they haven't been super proactive about sharing that either.
No, I mean, there's some conversations happening, but. So it's one of the issues is this is self-report data. So people who are willing to share their streams, they've been willing to be in this panel for over a year studying, you know, being part of questions about the election. The scholars argue that indeed these samples reflect what you might expect anybody to be doing if they were sharing. And I'm not sure I completely buy their justification that this is representative. So we have to temper with every one of these studies on fake news. You've got to temper it with what have other studies found, what questions weren't asked, what are the limitations? And that's just kind of the hard thing about dealing with all of this good research coming out.
And so this was also the important thing, as you mentioned, this was 2 years ago, this particular study. I mean, and 2 years just seems like so many things have changed when it comes to not just platforms, but our knowledge and how we consume this. So when we look at all of the research on this, what do you think is most important now, 2 years on from the election?
So a couple of things kind of come to mind. The first is we can get at general motivations. We can get at general structural problems. We can get at questions about how partisanship and age, right, might affect propensity in the future to share this kind of stuff. But we can't predict what's going to happen with the latest new fake news site. One of the scariest things is actually a lot of these sites aren't stable. And so increasingly there's new technology that's actually shifting the URL of the fake news site in real time, making it harder for news organizations and for Facebook to actually catch those sites. And that is a whole other ballgame when you can't even track the websites themselves.
Right. So you can't, the traditional way that we thought you would know whether or not it's fake news to look at the URL, see where it comes from. As people become more sophisticated in hiding that, that's going to make things more difficult. One thing I thought was so interesting, Nikki, you and I were talking about this before we were on air, is that when we think about the idea of older Americans and them sharing more fake news, we also know that older Americans consume a lot of news. So is it just that fake news, because they're consuming so much news, fake news is just a part of it? Or do we know if there's an ability to distinguish that that's fake or not? Or if we're just, because their intake, there's so much news that's coming in, that's just a part of what they're consuming?
Right. So what this study did is it looked at the content consumed in aggregate, but it didn't do that. Can you tell if it's fake news? Can you not tell if it's fake news? So one of the difficulties, I think, is probably, I mean, it's a really good question about, you know, but the thing to really think about is the fact that people consume information that tends to reinforce their existing political predispositions. And what we know from the fact-checking research is that a lot of times it doesn't even matter if the news is shown as fake. People can accept that the news is wrong or fake or not true, and they just don't care. It's like, okay, I get it. That's fake news, but whatever. I mean, it makes the general point. That's
scary. But they think that about all news?
No, I mean, if they're presented with a fact check, for example,
okay,
and they're like, yeah, that story you shared was fake. You know, how do you feel about that? Oh, okay, I accept that maybe those details were wrong. I get that, but you know, the general principle that climate change is not happening is still true. Right. So partisanship and pre-existing cognitive biases, even if you're a sophisticated news consumer, affect your ability to understand and interpret the information and what your motivations are for sharing it.
So we just have about a minute left, Nikki, but then how would you suggest the news consumers who are listening to this think about the news that they're consuming and know that the figure, how can they discern what they're consuming and sharing?
This is a really difficult question. What we know is that people can recognize name brands, but there are also imposters that use those URLs and trick people. And I think that the listeners to this show are obviously ahead of the game when it comes to having media literacy. But I think knowing that you're approaching information with a pre-existing bias of your own really gives you sort of the self-reflection to ask questions about whether what you're seeing really tells the full story of what you need to understand about an issue.
So maybe when you're seeing a story, ask yourself, does this just confirm something I already thought or a belief that I already have?
Right. And can I trust this news source too? Those would be the questions to ask.
That's Nikki Usher. She's an associate professor in the College of Media at the University of Illinois. Nikki, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
For tuning into The 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. How do young children living in chronic poverty deal with traumatic experiences in their lives? That's the focus of University of Illinois social work professor Tara Powell in her latest research. In 2017, she developed an emotional coping program to help natural disaster survivors overcome their trauma. Her program was used to help survivors of the Harvey and Maria hurricanes. It had positive results. And recently, Powell's program was taken up by Save the Children as an intervention strategy for children affected by poverty and trauma early in their life. Teachers involved with the program say it's brought about positive change for them. To learn a little bit more about how this all started and how this can help children, Tara's with me now in our studios in Urbana. Hi, Tara. Welcome welcome back to the 21st.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So we actually first spoke with you about a year and a half ago, and at that time, there were a lot of hurricanes in the headlines, whether we were talking about Harvey or Irma or Maria. You were actually in Houston after Hurricane Harvey, and when we think about the immediate aftermath of a natural disaster, I think we always focus on the physical things, food, shelter, how people can help with that. What needs do you think we might be missing as far as mental health and trauma in the immediate aftermath of a natural disaster?
Yeah, so in the immediate aftermath of a disaster, a lot of times people are just in autopilot. And so right afterwards, they're really trying to get their basic needs met. But then when the disaster, few months after the disaster, people are starting to readjust, that's when a lot of the mental health symptoms come up. So acute stress disorder happens a lot right after the disaster. And that is, you know, having nightmares about the event, re-experiencing the event. But if you're having longer term mental health symptoms, you know, a lot of times those can come up months or even years after experiencing a disaster.
And is it different for children versus adults?
So a lot of the symptoms are very similar for children, or a lot of the different diagnoses are similar for children, but the way they manifest them are different. So a lot of times they might regress, they might have regressive behaviors, bedwetting, a lot of nightmares. Sometimes they'll have self-blame if something really bad has happened. And with adults, it's a lot more of re-experiencing the event, being hyper-alert or hyper-aroused when, you know, rethinking about the experience.
And I wonder how much the way children react to events has to do with how the adults in their life are reacting to and processing, thinking in particular when it comes to a natural disaster.
Yeah, absolutely. So many children mirror the reactions that their parents or care providers have. So if a care provider or parent is really stressed, the child will also become really stressed. And they might be much more likely to have anxiety symptoms, depression symptoms, post-traumatic stress symptoms.
And so what did you see after Hurricane Harvey? How did you see this unfold? And what were you doing to try to help people there?
Yeah, so I was working both with a lot of care providers, a lot of teachers, parents, to help better equip them to support the children that had experienced Harvey. So a lot of kids, not just in Houston, but also in the surrounding areas, so you've got Beaumont and more of the coastal areas, were really, really heavily heavily impacted by Harvey. And so what my work did was I went and I trained a lot of the teachers and parents on how to best support their children. Because from my past experience within Hurricane Katrina was my original experience within disasters, what we found is, you know, a lot of the kids, they would do okay if given the right resources, but if not, if they were continuously disrupted, then they would have excessive fear. So continue to think the hurricane's going to happen. If a storm happened, and this happened in Harvey as well, if rain happened, the children would have extremely high anxiety. So a lot of the work I do is to help better equip social workers, teachers, parents on how to help children cope with these kind of events.
And so what did you find in terms of the program that you've developed called Journey of Hope? Mm-hmm. How did you figure out how effective it was?
Yeah, so we actually have tested the program in a number of different areas. Right now, there's a study being done in Houston looking at the impact within Harvey-affected children. But previously, I've done research in Christchurch, New Zealand, after an earthquake, in Moore, Oklahoma, after a tornado, and in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, after a tornado. And then one thing that we did most recently was we thought, you know, a lot of the skills that we teach within the Journey of Hope program are actually applicable to children who live in high poverty settings, who experience chronic trauma, who maybe they don't experience an acute event or a collective event such as a disaster, but they have everyday experiences that they're going through. And so we just recently tested that in Tennessee, in rural Tennessee, in four schools in rural Tennessee, to see, does it have an impact there? And is the impact similar in children who are not affected by disasters, but ongoing complex trauma?
So what kind of tools are you giving these children?
Yeah, so what the program really focuses on is helping children understand and identify different common emotions that they may have but are amplified when they've experienced some kind of traumatic event. So within the program, we do a lot of psychoeducation. So giving the children information on, you know, different emotions, how they experience them, and then help them put words to their experiences. So for example, if a child experiences fear about something, helping them understand how they experience fear, but not only how they experience it, how they can cope with it themselves. So we don't tell them how to cope with it, but we provide them with resources to help them better cope. And we do that not just through discussion, but it's also through cooperative play, arts activities, interactive games.
I was going to ask what age range this is for.
Yeah, so we have four different curricula, actually, that we developed, started developing them post-Katrina, and have continued to edit and adapt, you know, as time has went on. But we have one is for ages four to six. Another one is for 7 to 10-year-olds. Another one is for 11 to 14-year-olds. And then we have 15 to 17-year-olds. So they're all very similar in their theoretical background, but we have different activities, and they look much different based on their age range, because it's going to resonate much different if you're 4 versus if you're 16.
My guest is University of Illinois social work professor Tara Powell. We're talking about her Journey of Hope curricula and how it's being used not just to help children affected by natural disasters, but now as well for children who are in impoverished circumstances. And Tara, as you were talking about natural disasters and thinking about poverty, I was thinking about all the natural disasters I've lived through and covered. The earthquake in Haiti, lots of hurricanes. I grew up in Miami, so Hurricane Andrew happened when I was in high school. And I do think that when there's something like, and I'm thinking of the Haitian earthquake in particular, because it happened in a country that doesn't have a lot of resources, I think it's very apparent to people how poverty affects children in that circumstance. Mm-hmm. What about with kids, as you're talking about where you're testing this in Tennessee, where maybe there isn't a natural disaster? What kind of circumstances and what kind of traumatic experiences are these children perhaps going through that maybe we don't see, that aren't as apparent as an earthquake?
Yeah. So in Tennessee, it's pretty complex. You know, in a lot of these rural areas with very low resources, there still is food insecurity. So children might not be getting breakfast or lunch. There's also a lot of children in the foster care system, so being taken away from their parents. And also within these areas, a lot of the children are highly impacted by the opioid crisis. So, you know, a lot of kids have caregivers or parents who might be addicted to a substance and might be removed from the home for that.
Mm, okay. And so that's just one set of circumstances. And what does it look like in terms of Save the Children and how Save the Children has adopted this? Where are they hoping to do this?
Yeah, so what Save the Children is actually doing now is they originally put the program in a lot of post-disaster settings. But what they've recognized is that it is applicable also in their long-term programming. So they have literacy and nutrition programs in high-poverty rural areas throughout the United States. And so now what they're doing is they're incorporating social-emotional programming, and that's through the Journey of Hope program, into some of these higher-risk areas where children have ongoing, complex, traumatic stress situations.
And when we think about the natural disaster situation, we think about Puerto Rico and we think about Houston. So Maria in Puerto Rico, Houston and Harvey, both of those were years ago, but I think what people don't realize who aren't in that area, who aren't living in that area, is that many people are still very much coping with this on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and I actually was just on the phone with some people from Puerto Rico this morning, and we're doing longer-term recovery work. And the issue with the longer-term recovery is that people aren't wanting to talk specifically about the hurricanes anymore. But the recovery is really, it can be really stressful and exhausting. And so now people are dealing with that chronic stress of trying to recover. You know, they might still be trying to rebuild their house for children. They could still not be in a stable school setting. And so it's really just that ongoing stress of trying to rebuild that can really take years.
Well, I'm just thinking of there are parts of Florida where from the storms from last year, people still don't have television or internet service. A big part of the areas that were affected in coastal Florida, kind of in the panhandle, they're just now getting to some places and restoring internet. Most of the time there's electricity, but just to think of someone not having an internet access for like 6 months.
Yeah, it was incredible with my work in Puerto Rico. So I've been working there since the hurricanes, but it was around February last year, and so they still didn't have, much of the island still didn't have electricity. A lot of the places I went didn't have running water. And, you know, still to this day, and it's been, you know, well over a year afterwards, their electrical grid could go out. You know, some places that are more rural, their water isn't necessarily clean all the time, and they don't always have running water. And I actually never drink the water there either. I always drink out of bottled water just because of the safety, for safety issues.
That said, I wonder what you want our listeners who are listening across Illinois to know what it's like to emotionally recover from these disasters over a long period of time.
Yeah, so I think, you know, most people will do better given the right resources. Most, you know, children and adults will do better, but it takes a long time to recover. I remember living and working in New Orleans post Katrina for myself, as both a disaster responder but also a survivor. You know, it just, the fear of having another hurricane is really scary. And you know, it's normal to continue to have these fears, but just having people recognize that it just doesn't go away after a few months or after a year. It takes a long time to recover.
That's Tara Powell. She is in the School of Social Work at the University of Illinois. We've been talking about her research and her work, particularly with children and emotional coping for children who are affected by trauma. Tara, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Nyla.
We'll be right back. That does it for us today. Coming up on Monday, as I mentioned earlier in the hour, we will be live from Springfield as our next governor is sworn in. Not just governor like J.B. Pritzker, but all the other statewide offices will be taking part in Monday's inauguration ceremony. So you can join us for a special edition of the 21st. We'll be live from the Bank of Springfield Convention Center, and we'll have continuing special coverage of the entire inauguration ceremony on Monday. And we'll be answering your questions about our new state government. Lots of you have sent questions in. You can keep them coming. Whatever questions you have about our next governor, if you're curious, for example, where state lawmakers stand on issues like taxes and marijuana, you can visit askthe21st.org. That's askthe21st.org. And we'll try to get to as many as we can on Monday. And not to worry, we will keep answering them after Monday, too. But it's a new feature we've rolled out this year for you to ask us questions you'd like us to answer. So check that out. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, just go to our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Vishesh Anand, Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Make sure you tune in Monday. We'll be live from Springfield.